Last week, we just started in our study of Exodus chapter 16. This week, we're going to continue that study and talk about the provision of the manna to sustain Israel. But unlike the Sunday school version of the story, there's so much more to this episode than meets the eye. So let's begin by reading this rather long chapter in its entirety. Exodus chapter 16. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it starts on page 77. Exodus chapter 16. Follow along with me. They traveled on from Elim, and the whole community of the people of Israel arrived at the Sin Desert between Elim and Sinai on the 15th day of the second month after leaving the land of Egypt. There in the desert, the whole community of the people of Israel grumbled against Moshe and Aharon. And the people of Israel said to them, "We wish Adonai had used his own hand to kill us off in Egypt. There we used to sit around the pots with the meat boiling. We had as much food as we wanted. You've taken us out into this desert to let this whole assembly starve to death." And Adonai said to Moses, "Here, I will cause bread to rain down from heaven for you. The people are to go out and gather a day's ration every day. By this I will test whether they will observe my Torah or not. On the sixth day, when they prepare what they brought in, it will turn out to be twice as much as they gather on the other days." Moshe and Aharon said to all the people of Israel, "This evening you will realize that it has been Adonai who brought you out of Egypt, and in the morning you will see Adonai's glory, for he has listened to your grumblings against Adonai. What are we that you should grumble against us?" Moshe added, "What have I said will happen when Adonai gives you meat to eat this evening and your fill of bread tomorrow morning? Adonai has listened to your complaints and grumblings against him. What are we? Your grumblings are not against us, but against Adonai." And Moses said to Aaron, "Say to the whole community of Israel, come close into the presence of Adonai, for he has heard your grumblings." And as Aharon spoke to the whole community of the people of Israel, they looked towards the desert, and there before them the glory of Adonai appeared in the cloud. And Adonai said to Moshe, "I have heard the grumblings of the people of Israel. Say to them, at dusk, you will be eating meat. In the morning, you will have your fill of bread. Then you will realize that I am Adonai your God." That evening, quails came up and covered the camp, while in the morning there was a layer of dew all around the camp. And when the dew had evaporated, there on the surface of the desert was a fine, flaky substance, as fine as frost on the ground. And when the people of Israel saw it, they asked each other, "Manhu," which means, "What is it?" Because they didn't know what it was. And Moses answered them, "It's the bread which Adonai has given you to eat. Here is what Adonai has ordered. Each man is to gather according to his appetite. Each is to take an omer per person for everyone in his tent." The people of Israel did this. Some gathered more, some less. But when they put it in an omer measure, whoever had gathered much had no excess. Whoever had gathered little had no shortage. Nevertheless, each person had gathered according to his appetite. And Moshe told them, "No one is to leave any of it until morning." But they didn't pay attention to Moses. Some kept the leftovers until morning. It bred worms, it rotted, which made Moses angry at them. So they gathered it morning after morning, each person according to his appetite, but as the sun grew hot, it melted. On the sixth day, they gathered twice as much bread, two omers per person, and all the community leaders came and reported to Moses. And he told them, "This is what Adonai has said. Tomorrow is a holy Shabbat for Adonai. Bake what you want to bake, boil what you want to boil, and whatever is left over, set aside and keep for the morning." They set it aside till morning, as Moses had ordered, and it didn't rot or have worms. And Moses said, "Today, eat that, because today is a Shabbat for Adonai. Today you won't find it in the field. Gather it 6 days, but the seventh day is Shabbat. On that day there won't be any." However, on the seventh day, some of the people went out to gather, and they found none. Adonai said to Moses, "How long will you refuse to observe my mitzvot, my commandments and teachings? Look, Adonai has given you the Shabbat, the Sabbath. This is why he is providing bread for 2 days on the sixth day. Each of you stay where you are. No one is to leave his place on the seventh day." So the people rested on the seventh day. The people called the food man. It was like coriander seed, white. It tasted like honey cakes. And Moses said, "Here is what Adonai has ordered. Let 2 quarts of man be kept through all your generations so that they will be able to see the bread which I fed you in the desert when I brought you out of Egypt." And Moshe said to Aharon, "Take a jar and put in it 2 quarts of man and set it aside before Adonai to be kept throughout all your generations." Just as Adonai ordered Moshe, Aharon set it aside before the testimony to be kept. The people of Israel ate man for 40 years until they came to an inhabited land. They ate man until they arrived at the borders of the land of Canaan. Three million Israelites are hungry. They've been gone from Egypt for nearing 2 months. Their food supply is running out. They come to Moses. They want to know why he'd bring him out into the desert wilderness just to die from starvation. Moses takes his complaint to Jehovah. The Lord responds. And God tells the Hebrews that he's going to feed them. And he's going to rain bread down on them from heaven. Now, the Hebrew word for bread is lechem. But lechem also is a general word that means food. Just like the old-fashioned term breaking bread together. Technically, it meant to take a loaf of bread and break it or cut it and share it. But most often, it simply meant to eat a meal together. Bread here just means food in general, not literal bread. Then God starts to set up and teach an important principle to the Israelites by means of his commandments concerning the bread, the food, that he was going to supply them. And they were to gather all the manna they needed to satisfy their appetites, but only enough for 1 day at a time. And each day they were to do this except on the sixth day, then they were to gather a double portion, a 2 day supply. Well, here the story about the bread from heaven detours a little. Then it picks it up in a few verses. So rather than skip around, we're just going to follow the flow of the Bible. Something rather interesting is said in verse 6. It says, "Upon Moses and Aaron repeating the Lord's commandments concerning the gather of the manna, they say that this is so you shall know it was the Lord who brought you out of Egypt." Actually, what it says is, "So you shall know it was Jehovah who brought you out of Egypt." As I've mentioned on numerous occasions, well more than 9 out of 10 times in the Torah, you will see the words Adonai or Lord or God, but in fact, in original Hebrew, it's Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. That is the Lord's formal personal name. Now, the issue I'd like to point out is not about his name. It's that obviously the Israelites had real doubts as to who it was that was responsible for their leaving Egypt. We've already seen a couple of incidents where difficulties arise. Immediately, the Hebrews blame Moses. In other words, the people who were superstitious and believed in magic and sorcery, like most people from that era, weren't really convinced that it was this God Jehovah who had orchestrated the plagues back in Egypt, parted the waters of the Red Sea, and so on. Even with the cloud that led them by day, the fire that emitted from that cloud at night, the people doubted. Moses was the visible human presence. And so Moses caught all the grief. Therefore, as it says so clearly in this verse, part of the lesson from the manna was to teach Israel that it was Jehovah, not Moses, who rescued Israel from Egypt. This is a lesson that Israel will not fully grasp for decades. Now, the instruction that Moses and Aaron received from God about the food God would supply, they now pass on to the people of Israel. And in verse 7, Moses and Aaron remind the people that while they may think that all their griping and murmuring and complaining is directed at their human leaders, in fact, it is Yehovah who they are expressing their displeasure with, and Yehovah hears them. Moses goes on to tell Israel that God knows their needs and will, of course, supply it. He tells them that at sunset, what's sunset mark? The beginning of a new day. God will give them meat to eat. Then in morning, still the same day, give them bread, food, satisfy their hunger. And in verses 9 and 10, Moses then instructs Aaron to call for the entire community of Israel to come near to the presence of God. They obeyed, and as they looked out into the desert wilderness that lay ahead of them, they saw the glory of God in the cloud. Now, this phrase, the glory of God, is the English translation of the Hebrew words, kevod Yehovah. Is this kevod Yehovah some new divine experience for Israel? To look upon the cloud and see the glory of God? Of course not. It's been that same cloud, that same presence of God, that has been leading them, that has been protecting them from the Pharaoh's army, and had been fully available for their vision every single day, all day since they left Egypt. So why did Moses have to tell these people to stop, look up, and come near to God's presence? Because while God's presence is available to us, we must choose to come near to him. What is it we hear preacher after preacher admonish to do? Keep our eyes upon Christ, who is our present day glory of God. Israel had either taken their eyes off the cloud of God's glory or not fully recognized that the cloud was the presence of God. So they became disheartened, disoriented. The same thing happens to us. You know, we get so used to the idea of Yeshua being with us, guiding us, such that he becomes like an old piece of furniture or just another feature of the landscape. And so he goes unnoticed in our lives. God's presence had never left Israel. It was the people who had just quit looking upon it. It was sunset, verse 13 says, when a vast horde of quails suddenly fluttered down upon the startled camp of Israel. Now, reminding us a little of Egypt, when God used natural elements of his creation in extraordinary ways to smite Pharaoh and his people, Yehovah uses the quail in a supernatural way to bless his people. Quail migrating across the Sinai and the Arabian peninsulas at that time of year is normal. That they would swoop down for a rest en masse, having grown exhausted from their long flight, was not an uncommon occurrence. That they would do it at God's command in such a vast quantity, at the exact spot it was needed, that was the supernatural aspect of this miracle. Now, one can only imagine the Hebrews' wonder and awe. What a day they had just experienced. Called by Moses to come near to the Kevod Yehovah, the glory of Yehovah, they had once again experienced the Lord's awesome presence in their lives, and they had become comforted. But before dark, God also brought them meat from the sky, and they went to bed with their bellies full. And then they arose in the morning from a restful sleep that only comes from being fully satisfied. The rising sun. Well, that revealed an even greater miracle, because upon the desert sands was something that looked like delicate frost. It was everywhere. Verse 13 says, the Hebrews looked upon it and asked one another, what is it? In Hebrew, manhu, from which we have derived the word mana, manna. Now Moses tells them that it is the bread, the lechem, meaning food, in this case, from heaven that God had promised to send them to sustain them. The passage also explains that the coming of the manna each day was associated with dew. Now taken together with the description in Numbers 11:9 that says, when the dew fell on the camp at night, the manna would fall upon it. We get a more complete picture. There would be a fall of dew, and then the manna would flutter down upon it, and then another layer of dew would fall over the manna. Apparently, this is a manna sandwich. At the least, it kept the manna clean and fresh. Well, Moses issues an interesting instruction concerning the manna. Each man is to gather as much as he thinks is needed to fully satisfy himself. Yet at the same time, they were told to gather an omer, which is about a half gallon for each person. I want to make a quick note for you who have heard the term omer used in a different way, because it's associated with the biblical feasts of Passover and unleavened bread. An omer is more correctly associated with being a sheaf. So in the ritual of bringing in the first omer, now we're talking about Shavuot, it simply means bringing in the first sheaf of grain stalks from the harvest. Only here in Exodus, is the omer some kind of measurement of volume. Perhaps it's equal to the amount of grain that can be plucked off of a typical sheaf of grain stalks. Not sure. Anyway, when the Hebrews went out and gathered the manhu, a very strange thing happened. Whether they gathered more than an omer or less than an omer in their baskets, when they put it into an omer-sized jar, everybody had the same amount. Now, the meaning of this has been the source of many interesting commentaries. But at the bottom of it is what the Israelites would have learned from this mystery. There was no need to hoard. There was no need to rush out to be the first one to gather or to worry if there would be enough provision available from God for all of them. In God's economy, His bounty is endless. And you know, I'll tell you something else. Equality is not about giving everybody exactly the same. It's about giving to each person fully what they need. Verse 19 brings with it another reminder from Egypt. Passover, to be specific. The Hebrews are to gather each day only enough manhu to eat that day, and they are to dispose of the remainder, leaving nothing overnight. Do you remember that same instruction for the Passover ram? They were to eat their fill, but they were to dispose of the remainder before morning. Unfortunately, many of the Israelites ignored that part of the teaching. And to their disgust, they found the leftover manna rotted and otherwise inedible. It's kind of funny, isn't it? We tend to look at God's instructions and commandments, and we follow the parts of them that make sense to us. Then we just kind of ignore the parts that don't. Now, I'm not suggesting that a mechanical legalism by any means is a better avenue to follow. But here we see God's position on obedience. And we see how divine blessing can be ruined by man's rebellion. Or worse, by our personal determination of which of God's commandments ordinances are important and which ones aren't. Well, in verse 22, they were instructed that on the sixth day they were to gather double the normal amount of manna. And in verse 23, that the reason for this is that the seventh day is a Sabbath of holiness to Yehovah, and therefore none is to be gathered on the Sabbath. They were given permission to prepare the manhu however they wished. Bake it, boil it, whatever. But it had to be done before the end of the sixth day. And by the way, God was not going to rain down any manna on the seventh day. We have here the first reestablishment of Sabbath for the Hebrew people. In other words, while indeed Sabbath keeping would be part of the formal law given by Yehovah to Moses upon Mount Sinai, the Sabbath had already been established, first at creation. Now, here, in regards to the gathering of manna, prior to the law being given. Well, after the experience of gathering the extra manna, not using it up and finding it all full of worms and maggots the next morning, one can only wonder what was going through the people's minds upon this instruction. Most did as they were told, and as they entered the Sabbath, sure enough, whatever they had prepared the previous night, well, it was still fresh and edible. And yet, after all that had happened, some people still got up on Sabbath morning, took their baskets, and they went out expecting to gather manna, as usual. Naturally, there was nothing to find. Now, this behavior absolutely infuriated Moses. So he said, fine. You're all under house arrest on Sabbath. Stay where you are. Do not leave your tent on Sabbath. Stay home. Now, I want you to notice something very important. Throughout the Old Testament, there will be no call to communal worship, that is, an assembly of worship, on Sabbath. Sabbath is depicted as one thing and one thing only, the day of rest. And the command of Moses for people to stay where? In their tent homes on Sabbath. That's the model for this. Now, we could probably spend an entire session doing nothing but discussing all the pertinent meanings and commands God has ordained concerning the Sabbath, of setting our regular labor aside, not gathering our sustenance on the Sabbath, or even of Moses ordering the Israelites to stay home. If we were to study the way Shabbat, Hebrew for Sabbath, is observed by traditional Jews, we would find every effort is made to maintain the intent of God's commandments concerning the Sabbath. However, we're not going to stop here and do that. A little later on in Exodus and more in Leviticus, we'll go into the Sabbath in further depth. And I tell you from the heart, I'm unsure of just what to present to you about the Sabbath, because it is complex and it is full of reverence for our holy God that has been almost completely obscured by an anti-Jewish doctrine-based church. Now, let me just say something briefly about it for now to give you some food for thought, because while the Sabbath is important to God, it's also a very thorny issue for a lot of Christians. Now, whether you believe that some or none or all of the traditional 613 commandments of the Mosaic Covenant pertain to Christians, the fact is that the keeping of the Sabbath as holy is one of the Ten Commandments that forms the pillar of the church. I mean, I don't think anybody here would disagree with that point. And I also don't think that we take the matter of the Sabbath seriously enough. Nowhere in the Bible has God rescinded the command of the Sabbath. Nowhere in the Bible does it say that for our modern generation or since the advent of Christ that it's okay to work 7 days a week or to ignore the Sabbath. Many church leaders have taken Paul's meaning in Colossians 2 to mean that the institution of the Sabbath can be made into anything man wants to, which, by the way, makes no sense whatsoever to understand it that way, and this is what happens when Bible passages are taken out of context in order to try to validate a predetermined agenda or a doctrine. Now remember this. In the Sermon on the Mount, another pillar of the church, Jesus says in Matthew 5:17, no way has he come to abolish the Torah, or as many Bibles say, the law and the prophets. Further, that not the slightest detail, or not a jot or a tittle, a ute or a stroke, is going to pass from the Torah until all, or from the law, until all heaven and earth passes away. The Sabbath is a rather significant element of the Torah, wouldn't you say? Also remember, it's well documented. It's a historical fact that some parts of the early church continued to follow the biblical rule of the Sabbath, as Saturday, right on up until Emperor Constantine ordered the Sabbath abolished and then replaced it by something called the Lord's Day, which was to become the new day in which the Gentile church would come together to worship. Now, this new day of worship, the Lord's Day, was designated to be the first day of the week, Sunday, which was already the traditional day of national worship for the dominant religion of the Roman Empire, the Mishraim sun worshipers. Which is why, by the way, Sunday is called Sunday. This day was chosen as a political compromise between the sun worshipers and the Christians. Now let me quote directly for you from a couple of edicts handed down in the early 300s AD when this all happened. And by the way, the ancient official documents I'm quoting from, you can find in the local library. Or you can get it on the internet. Google it. First, the very first so-called Sunday law, ordered and enacted by Constantine during his second meeting with the Council of the Church Bishops in Nicaea, was in 321 AD. And here is a quote directly from that document. On the venerable day of the sun, the sacred day of the sun god, Sunday, let the magistrates and people resting in the cities rest, residing in the cities rest, and let all workshops be closed. In the country, however, persons engaged in agriculture may freely and lawfully continue their pursuits, because it often happens that another day is not so suitable for grain sowing or vine planting, lest by neglecting the proper moment for such operations, the bounty of heaven should be lost. Given the seventh day of March, 321, Crispus and Constantine being consuls, each of them for the second time. What happened in these several councils of Nicaea and Laodicea was that the Gentile Christian church was officially established and the Jewish Christian church was officially abolished. Some 16 years after these first Sunday laws were enacted, the following edict was handed down from another of these Roman church councils called the Council of Laodicea, and I quote, Christians shall not Judaize by being idle on Sabbato, the Sabbath, but shall work on that day. But the Lord's Day, Sunday, they shall especially honor, and as being Christians shall, if possible, do no work that day. If, however, they are found Judaizing and observing Sabbath, they shall be excommunicated. There you have it. Understand that in this context, Judaizing simply referred to Christians doing anything that Jews traditionally did. So, for example, if Jews honored the biblical feasts, Christians should not. If Jews baptized by immersion, Christians should not. If Jews lit candles and ate challah bread on the Sabbath, Christians should not. And since Jews honored the Sabbath, then Christians should not. The principle that was begun in the 4th century and now firmly entrenched in the modern church was this: if the Jews do it, Christians shouldn't. Christians who did anything Jews did in relation to honoring God were considered to be Judaizers. And this would result in being excommunicated from the church. Now, I know this is not an easy subject, but at the risk of offending you, I must say that the reason it's not so easy is because we love our traditions and we prefer our doctrines to what God's scriptures tell us. That's why. So we run around twisting and allegorizing the Bible in order to have it mean what our religious authorities have decided they want it to mean. There are plenty of passages in the Bible, believe me, that are difficult, and their understanding is not so straightforward. But the passages on Sabbath aren't like that. They are plainly spoken. They're unequivocal. Now, allow me to give you the view of the Catholic Church, the original Church of Rome, concerning Sunday rather than Sabbath worship. And by the way, Catholics lay claim to Constantine as one of theirs. Now, what I'm about to read to you comes from the official publication of the Catholic press, the official Catholic newspaper. It was written a little over 100 years ago. I quote, "Sunday is a Catholic institution, and its claim to observance can be defended only on Catholic principles. From beginning to the end of Scripture, there is not a single passage that warrants the transfer of weekly public worship from the last day of the week, Saturday, to the first, Sunday." Isn't that an interesting comment? I hope you understand what I just quoted to you. The Catholic Church, who claims the establishment of Sunday as the day of communal worship for Christians, says outright, nowhere in the Holy Scriptures, Old Testament or New, is there a single passage of Scripture that would allow the first day of the week worship and rest to be substituted for the God-ordained seventh day. None. Doesn't exist. That statement is factually true, at least in the sense of rest. But the reality is, and hear this please, the Bible ordains no particular day of worship at all. So why was that statement made and communicated to the world? Why would the Catholic Church say such a thing? Because it sounds as if it's condemning itself for Sunday worship by openly admitting the truth that scripturally there's nothing to indicate any day other than the seventh, Saturday, as the Sabbath. You see, what I quoted to you was part of an ongoing argument against Protestants, who, of course, deny the all-important doctrine of the Catholic Church that the Pope has special authority given to him directly from God to change, to add to, or to subtract from the Scriptures. So in yet another article continuing this debate, again from the official Catholic press, we get this, and again, this is a direct quote. "Protestantism, in disregarding the authority of the Roman Catholic Church, has no good reason for its Sunday theory and ought to logically keep Saturday as the Sabbath." Kind of mind-blowing to hear this, isn't it? In other words, the Catholic Church openly admits there's no scriptural authority at all for abolishing or moving the Sabbath to Saturday, to Sunday. However, since in their view, the Pope has the authority from God to change anything that he believes God has directed him to change, then the act of the Roman Catholics, Constantine and the Roman bishops, in abolishing the Sabbath and instead observing Sunday as a new and different day of rest and worship called the Lord's Day, it's okay and it's logical. The Catholics view Constantine as a pope. And conversely, since Protestants broke away from the Catholic Church several centuries ago, and since Protestants deny the authority of the Pope and the Catholic Church as empowered by God to alter scriptural commandments, then the question is, on what basis can Protestants possibly say they can change the Sabbath? The implied answer is, there isn't any. And in another Catholic press article, it's well to remind Presbyterians, Baptists, Methodists, all other Christians that the Bible does not support them anywhere in their observance of Sunday. Sunday is an institution of the Roman Catholic Church. And those who observe that day observe a commandment of the Roman Catholic Church. I hope that hits you where it ought to. I mean, do you understand that the Catholic Church completely acknowledges that Sunday observance is not a biblical command? Rather, it's a command of the Roman Catholic Church government. I hope that bothers you a little bit. Matter of fact, a whole lot. Now, believe me, I understand how uncomfortable it is to scrutinize traditions and doctrines that have been mainstays of the Christian Church. But discomfort is just not a good enough reason to skirt the issue. Or worse, to just disregard the plain scriptural truth. Let me frame this just a little differently. How about we solve this? How about if each Christian denomination just votes to decide which day they want a Sabbath? How about a seed of Abraham determines by majority rules that Tuesday, third day of the week, you know what? That would be a good Sabbath for us. Would you be very comfortable with that? For most of us, not very comfortable at all. Because hopefully we'd ask ourselves, by what biblical authority can we do that? But if we took Paul to mean what is most often taught that he said about the Sabbath, that is, that men can make Sabbath pretty much any day they want, then why can't we just move it around and do whatever we feel like with it? As a matter of fact, why not just make the Sabbath different every week? Change it from year to year so we're fair and equitable. Have four Sabbaths running together at the end of the month so we can have more time off. Sounds good, doesn't it? How about just no Sabbaths at all? Be workaholics. See, I see some of you kind of frowning, some a little laughing. That's the problem with trying to defend these traditional Gentile churches' dubious positions that we can change the Sabbath and observe it any way we please. If you decide that's really so, then that means we can do anything that suits us. And we all instinctively know that can't be the case. And indeed, that's not what Paul said. It's not what he suggested, and it's not what he meant. Now, I'm not advocating moving all church services to Saturday, although I think it would be very healthy if every church had Saturday services like we have. Because there is no such thing as a God-commanded day of worship. Doesn't exist. Jews and Gentiles have decided each upon their own. And in both cases, these are man-made doctrines, not commandments of God. The reality is that every day is a good day to worship God. But every day is not Shabbat. Every day is not the seventh day. Every day is not the seventh day. Every day is not the day that God ordained in Genesis as the Sabbath, which is reinforced here in Exodus at Mount Sinai and all throughout the Bible, including, by the way, the New Testament. Let's all remember that Yeshua himself, Jesus Christ, observed the seventh day Shabbat. But as individuals or as families, we can certainly honor God's Sabbath, the seventh day, and still participate in the Lord's Day. If we want to do that, like we're doing right now, there's nothing wrong with that. Just understand what we're doing right now is a tradition. But what the Jews do on Saturday at synagogue, that's also a tradition. It's not the Bible to do that. We can honor the day God ordained as Sabbath by taking God's intent to what? Rest. Be with our families on the seventh day. So I'm not here to condemn any denomination or to tell you to abandon Sundays. But I am saying that Shabbat is an important enough issue that as Christians, we can't do whatever we wish just because traditionally we always have. Well, in verse 32, God has commanded that a jar of manna, be set aside as visible proof for all future generations of this miracle of God's provision during Israel's time in the wilderness. So where is this jar of manna today? Well, when they find the Ark of the Covenant, they'll probably find the jar of manna, because the Ark almost certainly contains the stone tablets of the Ten Commandments, Aaron's budding staff, and the jar of manna. However, the meaning for verse 34 about placing the manna before the testimony, it says, that's just another name for the law or the Torah, the testimony is not to place it inside the ark, but rather to place it in front of the ark. Even so, you can bet that when they do find the ark, the pot of manna will probably be in it. Because the evidence is that whenever the ark traveled, the manna and Aaron's rod were placed inside of it. Now, as we near the end of chapter 16, I want to point out something of a general nature that students of the Torah need to know. Moses did not personally write all the five books of Torah, which are often called the five books of Moses. When someone asks me who wrote the Torah, I commonly say Moses, but only as a broad general response. The rabbis have always recognized that other recorded parts of the Torah were written in retrospect after Moses was dead and gone. We get an example of this here, because the words of verse 35 say, they ate manna all 40 years in the wilderness and until they came to settle in the land of Canaan. So for those of you who might say, wait a minute, how can these verses be speaking of stone tablets and an ark that haven't even been created yet because they still haven't arrived at Mount Sinai? Remember, the Torah is not in perfect chronological order. Let me put it another way. Moses did not write a daily journal. Moses didn't write down a few sentences about what happened today, and then some more tomorrow, and so on and so forth, like a news report, until the Torah was completed. No, most of the events and instructions we see in the Torah were written by Moses and others after the fact, as history, so that it was coherent, it was understandable for future generations. Well, chapter 16 closes by giving us the interesting piece of information that Israel ate manna for 40 years. God provided them with that heavenly food for their entire time in the wilderness. But the moment they entered the promised land, it quit coming just as quickly as it began. Well, next week we'll take up Exodus chapter 17.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning, products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.